Vox Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. Along with your calls, some topics to talk over, Zorba?
Yes, we'll talk about the Dr. Oz show, Muhammad Oz, and how truthful is he when it comes to medical claims that he touts on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And new recommendations published in the Annals of Internal Medicine that looks at high blood pressure, when we should treat it earlier than many of us have been treating it, frankly, and then what is the result?
Mm-hmm. And a yummy recipe?
Chicken and pepper stew. It's a great recipe for this time of year. I am sure that you will love it.
Sounds
easy,
good to me.
Simple, delicious.
800-462-7413. You'll find a line open right now as we welcome our first caller. A listener joins now in Springfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
A couple of weeks ago, Zorba and you had a conversation concerning hygiene for the ears and how to clean the ears, but I didn't hear any opinions concerning the use of ear candles, and I was wondering how Zorba felt about using ear candles to remove earwax.
Let me ask, do you use ear candles?
I have used them a couple of times on occasion, but not recently.
So apparently they didn't work very well for you then.
They seem to pull out a lot of wax. But for a little time afterwards, I would get wetness inside of my ear, and I would sop that up with a swab. And it never continued after that point. It would go away overnight, so to speak. It wasn't a lasting problem. But I'm not very clear on what was going on there in my ear, you know, after I'd used the ear candle.
I've got to say, I've heard of ear candles, but I don't have a clue as to what it is or how it works. Can you tell us what you do when you use, is it a candle that you stick in your ear and light it, or what happens?
The way they manufacture this is like a gauze that's been dipped in wax and then rolled into a funnel shape that is tapered at the end. This end is to go into your ear. Then you are to lay on your side and place something protective around your head, of course, like a pie plate, I've heard, a pie pan with a hole through it, or a wet cloth, is what's recommended on the packaging. And then you light the top of the candle, and the vacuum created by the heat at the top of this candle is what is pulling the earwax, I'll call it earwax, into your ear, or into the candle, out of your ear. And you let it burn down to, say, it just depends on how timid you are, I imagine. But, you know, how close you let it burn to your head, you know. After that, I haven't heard a lot of things about them as far as the effectiveness of them or how, you know, they recommend maybe burning it down to 4 or 5 inches. But is there a time before then when the job would be considered done that you might take the thing out before it gets that short? You know?
I've got to say, hearing this description, this is either magic or a fraud.
Now, don't you remember, Tom, we took pictures. We got an ear candle a couple of years ago, and we took pictures of me down in the lobby.
I have no memory of that.
At Wisconsin Public Radio, and lit the candle.
Did
and
we
you were,
really do that?
And you were laughing. I think you were laughing, or maybe it seemed like you were laughing.
Well, the wax must have gotten into my brain, because I totally forgotten about that.
That's exactly it. So, ear candles. Only ancient thing that is supposed to work. Like you said, it's tapered at one end, and then you light a candle, and you have to make sure not to burn yourself or burn your house down. And the idea is that, the supposed idea is that there will be heat carried down, which then produces suction, which is actually going to pull wax out of your ear. The only problem is just reach below the candle, and you'll see how much heat is transferred. I mean, candle has, there's some remarkable insulating ability, so there is really no suction at the other end. And one way that you could see if there was suction at the other end, our ears are very, very sensitive. If there really were suction, just put it slightly in the ear and you should hear like a little whoosh. And instead, you'll maybe hear the drip, drip, drip of the candle far away, but you won't hear any suction. So I don't think they work. But people use them for pain. They say they feel better. And that may work because it's comforting to have something in your ear that's pliable and may keep the moisture in. And then it sort of is like Vicks VapoRub in that it makes you feel better, like you're doing something. But it really doesn't clear the wax or soften it. Now wax is very interesting. Some people have dry wax. Some people have moist wax. Some people have a lot of wax. Some people have a little wax, and it actually has a function of protecting the eardrum on the inside of the ear. I have people come to my office sometimes twice a year to get their ears cleaned out. And for the most part, I recommend going and getting an earwax removal drop, put it in the ear following directions and flushing it out if you're bothered. If you're not bothered and your hearing isn't decreased, generally I don't recommend anything because quite often the wax is just sort of protecting your canal from dirt.
Wonderful. I did not know. It sounds very valid and like something I should follow.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Recommend
thank you.
Others follow.
My pleasure. Very nice to
you. We appreciate the call. My mother used to say, the only thing you should ever put in your ear is your elbow.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's true.
800.
When was the last time you put your elbow in your
ear?
Well,
I know. That's the point.
You know,
well,
I wonder if circus performers or people who dislocate
their elbow
shoulder.
In their ear.
Well, if you dislocate your shoulder chronically, could you get it up to the ear?
Well, maybe Houdini could have, but
Houdini,
nobody who's still alive. 1-800-462-7413. And a Coeur d'Alene, Idaho listener joins in now. Hi.
Hey, gentlemen. How are we doing?
Fine. How can we help?
My wife suffers from chronic depression, and we like to take more of a natural approach to things instead of jumping right into a bunch of pharmaceuticals. And, you know, we're a pretty active couple. We do yoga, work out, dabble in meditation. We're thinking about trying some acupuncture to treat it. And I was just kind of wondering what your thought on what might work better or not so much would be for Zorba.
A question. First of all, has your wife gotten counseling? Have you gone to counseling at all?
Briefly. Uh-huh. And it was so-so.
Mm-hmm. So, because one type of counseling that's good and is non-pharmacologic is called cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. And there are counselors who kind of specialize in that. And if she hasn't tried CBT, I would highly recommend it. There's good data. It's one of the few counseling techniques that has great scientific data behind it. And I would, you know, specifically look at that. And CBT counseling is where, you know, you learn to look at your thoughts, sort of move away from those thoughts, not necessarily have the emotional response to thoughts that are there. So right off the back, if you're looking for a non-pharmacological way of looking at it, I would look at that. And the second thing I would look at would be an SAD light, seasonal affective disorder light. You can buy them on Amazon.com for $70. They're 10,000 lumens. That's what they are. And 20 to 40 minutes a day, you don't look directly into the light. You put it off to the side while you're at a computer. Help a lot of people with depression. Used a lot in the wintertime, but there's some people who use it once or twice a week in the summertime. Again, it's non-pharmacological way. We know that it works with seasonal affective disorder in winter. And whether or not it works with regular depression, some people it doesn't, some people it doesn't. I think exercise makes a big difference because we know that people who exercise are able to take stress better. I think diet makes a difference, you know, getting on making sure you're sort of eating the right foods in the right way, that you don't have a diet that's overloaded in carbs. I definitely would try chiropractic and acupuncture and see if that mattered. I think the supplements have the least data behind them. And St. John's Wort has some good data, but it can interfere with other pharmaceuticals, so you just have to be aware of that. But St. John's Wort definitely has some good data behind it. But the other supplements, I would save my money and I would do the non, you know, I wouldn't do a supplement pill.
I sense our caller is hesitant to go to drugs, but there are some good drugs for depression.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. We've tried mm-hmm. quite a few, and they've had some very adverse side effects that were sort of scary. I won't go in depth with them, but in regards to the diet, she's actually vegetarian mm-hmm. and has all of a sudden gotten kind of a lactose intolerance. and tries to stray away from carbs.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like that's a pretty reasonable diet. And lactose intolerance is common. Getting back to the drugs for a second, there are a variety of drugs. From tricyclic antidepressants, the older drugs that still are very effective, to specialized drugs like trazodone and Wellbutrin, which are specialized drugs. And then there are the SSRI antidepressants like Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft. And sometimes drugs will have side effects. Cymbalta is another one. And they'll have side effects for 2 to 4 weeks, and then your body gets used to it. And I mentioned Cymbalta. It's an antidepressant we use in chronic pain. And when people start it for the first 2 weeks to 4 weeks, they're nauseous. And then for some reason, the nausea goes away. Body just adjusts to it. So even though you've tried drugs and they've had side effects, it doesn't mean you gave it a full trial. And I think Tom brings that up as a good point, because if it's longstanding, the drugs do have proven efficacy.
Okay.
Okay, good luck. It can be a longstanding, common problem.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. It's sort of drugs and therapy are the same thing. Sometimes you have to juggle and try one and then try another and try another.
Right.
I think it's kind of tough sometimes to find a therapist that really fits whatever your need might be.
Absolutely. And that's what it is. I mean, finding a physician who can prescribe an antidepressant is easy. Finding a therapist who can talk your talk and the way you speak, in terms of personality, that is much more difficult.
Yeah. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. So, Zorba, let's talk about Dr. Oz.
Yes, Dr. Oz. First of all, full disclosure, I know Mamet. I've met him a number of times, and I think he's a great guy. But sometimes he goes off, like everyone else. And his show, he was initially the sort of expert on Oprah, and now he has his own show, and has had his own show for like 4 years, I bet, 3 or 4 years. Very highly watched show. And I periodically watch it myself, and I find that sometimes he oversteps. He was at a Senate hearing this summer. This was a study, an interesting study, that looked at Dr. Oz. The study came out of the University of Alberta in British Columbia, and they looked at 4 randomly selected episodes from 2013 of the Dr. Oz show. So the show offered an average of 12 recommendations per episode. That's a lot of recommendations. Mm-hmm. Do this, do that. Roughly 40% of the recommendations involve dietary advice. So you can see most people who watch Dr. Oz are overweight because they want to lose weight, 40%. By the way, that fits the national trend for self-help books. Most of them are diet. Researchers said they were able to find one case study or better evidence in about 40%. So in 40%, they could find a case study. That doesn't mean it was real. They found a case study or several case studies. But in a full 40%, there was no evidence at all. In other words, so 40% of these recommendations were no evidence. And he presents this information as evidence. And when you look at it, you realize, well, why is he presenting his evidence? He should say, well, this is my opinion. I think this would work. And then stay totally away from that whole, evidence. Because I think there's a potential harm with that. Because people believe him. They say it's on the Dr. Oz show. It must be real. And, of course, now there are a lot of people that are saying, as mentioned on Dr. Oz, even though he doesn't even say that he supports a claim. And it's a problem. It's a TV radio problem where we believe if it's on TV, it must be real. Otherwise, why would he have it?
Yeah, I know we get calls a lot about it. Does this supplement work or that supplement? Mm-hmm. You're pretty careful about recommending anything that you don't have good science on.
Right. I'm much more conservative than he is. And if there's something, I'll say, full disclosure in that. I don't really, know what it is, but this is my recommendation to do that sort of a thing.
Even though you were tutored by Bob Mendelsohn.
By Bob Mendelsohn, full disclosure.
Well, most of our listeners
he was a gadfly. No, they don't. If he were still alive, they would know. Bob was anti-immunization, home birth, but he said women should not go to women at that time went to the hospital and labored alone and didn't have friends and didn't have Lamaze. And he moved that into a much more humanistic way of giving deliveries. Sure. But he had a negative side. Don't immunize your children. So, yeah, I fell off of that side. Nonetheless, with Dr. Oz, it may be good information, but some of it, at least half, you have to take with a grain of salt.
800-462-7413. And a listener in Helena, Montana with us now. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Calling about artificial sweeteners and Splenda in particular. And I just wanted to know what the limit should be or can be in using those every day. And because one of the things that I have that makes it difficult is I've started a medication, methotrexate, again after about a year. And what I've noticed is what happened the first time I took it, and that is that my taste buds are much less perceptive than they used to be, less sensitive. And so what I end up doing is using more of the Splenda even than I'm doing now. So I wanted to ask your advice about what I could do about that, and just let me know that. So that's my question.
Oh, sure. Now, you're on methotrexate for rheumatoid arthritis or
yes.
For rheumatoid arthritis. And that's an anti-cancer
right.
drug, by the way, that's
right.
very effective in rheumatoid arthritis. It's been around, gosh, at least 30
forever.
Years. Yeah, forever. It's sort of been around forever. Right, ever in a day. So we know what it does. We know what the effects are and the side effects. And taste changes can be present with many, many drugs, and that is one of the drugs. I don't think there's a bottom line on Splenda. I've never read that. I mean, it's derived. It is sort of a sugar-like substitute, and I don't think, unlike saccharin, where I really would be careful and and people, you know, FDA tried to take saccharin off the market, and then people said, no, we want to have it. For some reason, they like that bitter aftertaste, but that's in sweet and low.
That's what happens with that.
Yeah, so I don't think there's any bottom line in this with Splenda. I think it can use as much. But now let me ask, how much is a lot?
Well, I would say half a cup maybe to three quarters probably.
Well, I was just reading about how much sugar the average American eats in prepared foods and soft drinks and others. Guess how much the average American eats per day.
Oh, I don't know. No idea.
It is a half a cup to a cup.
Go away.
That's what it is. When you look at the amount of sugar that's produced and the amount of sugar that's consumed and what products it's in so many prepared products, like 75% of the prepared products that you buy in the store, from Chef Boyardee beefaroni to Trader Joe's spinach panar Indian style. They have sugar.
Right.
Now, I don't know if the Trader Joe's one actually has sugar, but they use a lot of sugar in their types of sugar. So Americans actually eat a lot of sugar. And we're hardwired to eat it for a whole bunch of reasons because it was concentrated food. We just have too much of it. I don't think you're having any problem with Splenda, and I think you could go up to a cup a day without a problem at all.
Okay. It's just that it's really for putting in coffee and tea.
Mm-hmm.
I don't drink too much, you know. I just have black tea and a little bit of coffee every day. So it's just that, you know, that was something that I was worried about. And if I use Truvia or the other one, Stevia, they have kind of a bitter aftertaste if I put enough in. So.
Right. No, I definitely think Splenda is okay. I think you can use that, and that would be good. So how long are you going to be on the methotrexate?
Probably indefinitely. I was before. I take that and Humira.
Mm-hmm.
And I eat really well, and I get enough rest and exercise, so I know I'm doing the right thing.
Good.
I just wanted to be sure about that.
Good. And you can take Splenda, no problem at all. Good luck.
Okay.
Good luck.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate that. At 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's crack open the inbox for a food-related email question from a listener named Sarah. She writes, "Hello, Dr. Zorba. This is something I have been debating for a while. I kind of like putting cranberry sauce in my chili, but I am unsure how healthy it is. I've seen some stuff on the internet saying cranberry sauce is good for you, but I am concerned about the sugar content. I would greatly appreciate your thoughts on the matter." And I've got to say, it may not be unhealthy, but it certainly is a dumb idea.
No, it's not
cranberry
dumb to
sauce
her. It's not dumb to her. Cranberry sauce has sugar in it because cranberries are bitter. So read the label and that's how much sugar, you're getting.
I'm sorry, sir. I shouldn't have said dumb. I should have said it's not something I would do.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Tom's comment was dumb. That's what he meant. That's what he meant to
yes.
say. But you've never tried it. Maybe it would be good.
You're right.
You see? Maybe it would be good. Maybe this will lead the way.
Yeah. I haven't tried poking my eye with a sharp stick either.
It's not the same thing as poking your eye with a sharp stick. It's not exactly that bad. I'm going to try cranberry sauce on chili the next time I have chili and write her a note if I can find the email address, but we've got it. Anyway, yes, it does have sugar in it, but yeah. So do a lot of other things, and just pay attention to the sugar. But I think it sounds kind of delicious, a nice super hot chili with a little cranberry sauce on top. If you want to send us that recipe, do it. Yeah. Zorba@WPR.org. Send us the recipe, and maybe you can be a guest chef on the whole Zorba@WPR.org.
Short segment. Make your chili. Put some cranberries.
That's right.
Have a lingering question for Zorba? Post it to our Facebook page or send an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
A recipe is coming up, not a cranberry and chili recipe. More of your calls, of course, our medical myth buster too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number is 800-462-7413, the number you call if you'd like to join in. We have an open line now for you. But before our next call, recipe time, Zorba, chicken and pepper stew. Yummy.
Yummy. I knew that you would like this recipe.
Yeah.
So this is something you would like Monica to make.
Absolutely.
Does she cook?
No.
Oh, I see. That'll make it just a bit more different. How about the dog?
Dog doesn't cook either.
The dog doesn't cook. No. The fish?
Chicken
and
pepper stew.
That's as far as it goes.
Yeah. Okay.
Chicken and pepper stew. Start out with 18 ounces of chicken thighs cut into 2-inch pieces.
18 ounces of chicken thighs cut into 2-inch pieces.
And those are skinless chicken thighs that are cut into 2-inch pieces. So you know where they are. They're in the chicken part of the grocery store.
Yeah, I know where that is.
You shop in the grocery store.
I do.
Right? Yeah, you do. Yeah. Does she shop in the grocery store?
Yeah, whatever. Let's do the recipe.
Sorry, I'm just getting into the personal aspect of your
cares
life.
Who shops
I'm trying to reconstruct your life
recipe.
And see what it's about. A tablespoonful of flour.
Big tea flour.
Now, what I keep on hand is a proprietary flour called a Wondra, W-O-N-D-R-A. And I use that because I find it very useful in situations like this. It comes in a little tube, a little canister tube. Mm-hmm. They've been manufacturing it for maybe 40 years. Mm-hmm. I think it's made by Gold Metal or Pillsbury. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful for things like this because it's always fresh and it dissolves really well. Wondra, W-O-N-D-R-A.
Is that what they use in Wondra bread?
That's very good. I like it. You know, I bet it came from that, though. It's a concept because it's white. That's very, very good, Tom.
Okay.
How about 2 tablespoonfuls extra virgin olive oil?
2 big T extra virgin olive oil.
Are you going to play on that word, too?
No.
Okay.
I got nothing.
I got nothing. Okay. 3 cloves of minced garlic.
3 cloves of minced garlic.
A medium onion diced.
A medium onion diced.
A medium red pepper cut into 1-inch squares.
Medium red pepper cut into 1-inch squares.
A medium yellow pepper cut into 1-inch squares.
A medium yellow pepper. It's hard to do 1-inch squares.
Roughly. It's kind of.
Yeah, you just take it, chop it up, and
right.
Yeah, okay.
You make it. In other words, it's sort of a.
Nobody's judging.
Not at all.
Okay.
We would not judge you.
Right.
And by the way, if the red peppers and yellow peppers are too expensive, you can use green peppers. I mean, they're always cheaper. A tablespoon of good sweet paprika.
Big T, sweet paprika.
They come in a variety of names in the store. They're usually under the name Hungarian paprika. Do not buy paprika that's just on the spice shelf with all of the other spices. It's generally not good paprika. So find a paprika you like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? 14 ounces of stewed tomatoes pureed.
14 ounces of stewed tomatoes pureed.
That's right. And you might be able to find just pureed tomatoes that are stewed in the store. Mm-hmm. 2 tablespoons of tomato paste.
2 big tea tomato paste.
1/3 teaspoon of salt.
How much?
1/3 teaspoon of salt.
1/3 teaspoon of salt.
Just a little bit of thought. So, a little bit of salt.
Yeah.
Sorry. And some parsley.
Parsley, okay. Yeah.
So generously salt and pepper the chicken thighs, then dust them with the flour, like I said, one drill would even better. Heat a sauté pan over medium-high heat until it's hot. Add the olive oil. Swirl it to coat it. Add the chicken. Fry on one side until it's browned, and then flip and brown on the second side. Transfer it to a bowl. Then to the pan, add some garlic, and before you add the garlic to the pan, there's this stuff that sticks to the bottom of the pan called the frond, F-R-O-N-D. Mm. Do not throw that away. That adds a tremendous amount of flavor, but you have to get it off the bottom of the pan because it may stick too much and then burn.
Or you get it off and then put it back in.
Well, you do is you take a spatula and just kind of push it around. Yeah. You don't actually have to take it out. Add the garlic, onion, saute until it's tender and starting to brown. Then add the bell peppers and continue sauteing until they're bright in color and beginning to soften. Then add the paprika and saute just for a while until it's fragrant. That'll be a couple of minutes. Return the chicken to the pan along with the stewed tomato, salt, and tomato paste and simmer for 10 to 15 minutes until the chicken is cooked through. Remember, you've really made the chicken at least 3/4 cooked, if not completely cooked, when you sauteed it initially. A taste, a little more salt if you need it, garnished with chopped pepper. I would serve this maybe with buttered noodles. Hmm. I'd have some buttered noodles of some sort. I certainly would have a noodle dish or maybe a German or I think not kolachkis, but there's a Polish noodle dish. That's what I would have.
This would do bread and butter, I think.
Bread and butter would be good. Yeah. Would be good. Yeah. But you could do potatoes, but I think bread and butter or noodles with that. Yeah. And fruit on the side, because this is a hearty dish. So the last thing you want to do is serve a giant piece of chocolate cake.
Okay.
It's too much food.
If you would like to get this recipe.
Yes. Yes, go ahead.
It's your turn.
It's my turn. You mean I have to tell them?
Yes.
Go to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can see pictures of Tom, pictures of me. You can search the archives. That's zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, we are on that newfangled thing called Facebook.
800-462-7413, toll-free. Ann Zorba, a listener with us now in Pasadena, California. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I have an ongoing problem that's continued for years, which is whenever the weather gets really dry and I have to blow my nose, I get a nosebleed. And I used to use Vicks VapoRub, putting it on the inside of my nose. And then I read on the Vicks VapoRub jar that you're not supposed to put it in your nose. So now I've got the problem of what do I do to mitigate nosebleeds with that I just get regularly whenever the weather is dry.
Uh-huh. So before you answer, Zorba, why shouldn't you put Vicks VapoRub?
Well, first of all, you can put Vicks VapoRub.
I mean, that's all I ever
nose.
When I was a kid, it was stuck in my nose.
And the reason is some people, if they inhale it a lot, they inhale and they take a dip inhale, it can actually go into the lungs. Any sort of a Vaseline can do the same thing and cause a pneumonia, a type of pneumonia, irritation of lungs. So the Vicks people in a CYA mentality put down, do not put.
Cover your.
Cover your, and we will not say that word. We're in public radio. Put that down. Do not put in your nose. And it might also be in the Vaseline jar. I've never seen it there. Used to be on the carbolated Vaseline jar that my mother had. Do not put in your nose. But I think you can put it in your nose. Doesn't it smell kind of good?
Yeah, it does. And I don't really put it all the way in. I just kind of put it on the outside.
Yeah, no reason.
A chiropractor told me that once, and he said you won't have any nosebleed problems.
Well, the moisturizing, it works. Vaseline will probably work too, but I kind of like the smell of Vicks VapoRub. It makes me feel warm and cozy on the inside. Reminds me of my mom.
It makes you feel seven years old again.
It does. My image right now is 7 years old, and I'm sick, and my mother's rubbing my chest with a T-shirt, and I'm definitely ill. That's definitely, let me tell you, I'm right there. Right there. Did your mom use Vicks VapoRub?
Yeah, absolutely. And I loved it. Just
yeah.
Like you did.
Yeah, so it's, you can definitely do it. Now, when it gets dry, so in your bedroom, do you have a vaporizer?
No.
You may want to do that because you're dry. You're in your bed for about 8 hours a day. And you can get some of the dryness because you're in Pasadena. So it's Southern California. It's dry. And a vaporizer,
right.
Especially an ultrasonic vaporizer, they're quieter and the molecules are really smaller. And you may want to put one in your bedroom. And that may help you from getting as many nosebleeds. You might want to try it.
Okay. Now, one problem is we vacation in Wisconsin, and we have a house vaporizer there, a humidifier, not a vaporizer.
Uh-huh.
Is that the same thing?
Well, vaporizer, you pick up at the drugstore and you plug it in. Humidifiers sometimes are bigger. So you live in Wisconsin in the winter or in the summer?
Summertime.
Oh, summertime.
What kind of a question is that?
I just want to check and see. It was a question. It was a reasonable question. Maybe she was a cross country skier and she came to Wisconsin in the wintertime for the cross country skiing.
Cross country.
Exactly.
Only for holidays with the family do we go in the winter.
See, so she comes up to the winter. But you're from Wisconsin originally.
No, I'm a native Californian.
Oh.
But my partner, his kids are in Wisconsin.
Got you.
We go there.
Got you. So the family, it's family ties that bring you to our beautiful state.
Yes.
So try the vaporizer in the house. See if that makes a difference. And every time you put in the Vicks Vapor Rub, think of Mom.
I certainly will. Thank you very much.
You're
sure.
Welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. And Zorba, let's dive now back into the inbox and see what a listener named Denise has brewing. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I have an intolerance to caffeine. It makes my blood pressure go up, my lips go numb, and it makes my heart race. I seem to be having the same thing happen when I'm around e-cigarettes. Could this be related?"
Well, first of all, I don't think the e-cigarettes are related to caffeine because these cigarettes contain nicotine and they're really two different substances. But it might be possible that the pollution caused by e-cigarettes is causing your heart to race. I mean, I think people smoking e-cigarettes, adults, not children at home, is fine. I think it should be regulated just like regular tobacco products.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to have that smoke in my environment when I'm sitting in a restaurant now that we're smoke-free. And people who just smoke e-cigarettes willy-nilly are not only not very nice, but they're doing a disservice to society. Just like you should have it at home, have it at home. And if she's bothered by somebody smoking an e-cigarette, just like a cigarette, she should say, "Pardon me, will you please take that e-cigarette and shut it off?
Yeah.
It gives me a headache. Yeah. It causes my heart to race."
She says it makes my blood pressure go up, my lips go numb, makes my heart race.
Yeah.
Maybe she really doesn't like e-cigarettes.
Yeah, that's exactly
her.
It. It may be a mental thing, but I don't like e-cigarettes. I was walking through a museum, and somebody was smoking an e-cigarette, and I wanted to go up and say something, and I was with my wife Penny, and she dissuaded me from doing that.
Well,
guy was 6'4", and she thought he'd punch me out.
Can you smoke those things where cigarettes are not allowed?
Well, he was. Well, it all depends on state regulations. The states don't know what to do about it. I think it's pretty simple. It's your personal polluting device, and I think personal polluting devices should be kept in the home. You can pollute all you want to in the home or in your car, but do not pollute in my space.
I have a question for Zorba. Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Hang around here. We have another topic to talk about. More of your calls, of course, our medical myth buster, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Remember that number, 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, a new and I think important study on blood pressure,
treatment of blood pressure. So we've known for years, many, many years, since the famous study that came out in 1974, that treating high blood pressure will reduce stroke and heart attacks. And in fact, there has been a 70% reduction in stroke and nearly that in heart attacks.
Well, 70%.
Since we started effectively treating high blood pressure. The issue, there are a couple of issues. First of all, a lot of people still don't actually take medicine for their high blood pressure because they say, I'm not symptomatic. Why should I take a pill, one pill or two pills or three pills? And those people are simply wrong. You know, you want to take the pill before you're symptomatic. But this particular study looked at what we used to call mild high blood pressure, and this was in the range of 140 over 150. You know, blood pressure is kind of 120 over 70 as a goal, but 140 to 150, and the diastolic blood pressure between 90 and 99. Mm-hmm. And the medical community has gone back and forth on the effectiveness of the treatment in this milder group. So this study, recently published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, looked at this group, and they looked at studies of studies. So once again, it was a mega study, a compendium of the studies, which has some strengths and some weaknesses, putting all the data together to see whether or not it would make a difference. And I think in my mind, the data is definitive that once you get above 140, it should be treated. Now, there's some distances where we wait until 150, but generally 140 for most of us, not for all of us, and a diastolic blood pressure over 90, and they both should be treated. When I started practice, we only looked at the diastolic, that second number. We never looked at the systolic. Mm-hmm. And once again, there are some people that should be at 150, but most people should be below 140.
When you say treated, you mean pills?
Pills. Well, first you could try lifestyle. Lifestyle's okay. Cut out the salt as much as you can. Lose 10 to 20 pounds if you're overweight. Start exercising more. You may do it correctly. If you've only gone in and had one measurement, go in two or three or four times in your doctor's office and see what the measurement is. Some people have white coat hypertension. It's not real. Get rid of stress in your diet, all that good stuff. And that'll work for some people. But what I've told people now is let's put you on the pills. You then do the lifestyle. Then we'll take you off the pills. Because what happens is a good 90% never actually make the change to the lifestyle. Yeah. So start the pills and then see if you can get off. But I think this study, the real benefit of the study is then it then shows the importance of treating early high blood pressure and the reduction of strokes and heart attacks. The pills work. If you're recommended to take them, take them.
1-800-462-7413, toll free. Back to the phones now, Zorba, a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
How can we help?
Well, I've got an issue with my jaw just involuntarily snapping on my tongue. And it has created kind of a hole in my tongue. And just a little background, I had a surgery on my jaw, and I had what was called a dentigerous cyst, and it was right behind my back molar on the bottom. And they had to remove this, and I know that there was a nerve nearby, and what I'm wondering is if that was nicked or something like that, if it could make this involuntary snapping. And sometimes I could be talking as I am now and just snap on my tongue, and it really hurts. And if I sleep with my head to the right, it never happens. If I sleep with my head to the left or straight up, it can happen in my sleep.
So this is the jaw snapping and then catching your tongue in the back there?
Yeah, and so the underside of my tongue gets bitten by my molar.
Wow. And it's involuntary. You said you have a hole in your tongue now?
Yeah, just a little. It's kind of developing. It doesn't really heal anymore because this doesn't happen every day.
Mm-hmm.
It happens every couple days, a couple times a week.
Okay.
Sometimes at night I can go a week or two without it, but then all of a sudden, bam, and boy, does it hurt.
Oh, I bet, yeah. I mean, we've all bit our tongue. And
the cyst was about the size of a quarter right behind my bottom molar, the furthest back one, And it was right where, like, an impacted wisdom tooth was.
Got it.
So they had to take out the cyst and the tooth, and there was some concern about there's a nerve there, apparently.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if you had an opinion on it.
Well, how many weeks ago did you have the surgery?
Well, that would have been last April.
Okay, so you had the surgery some time ago. And does this only happen at night?
No, it can happen during the day.
Uh-huh. Does it happen a lot at night? Is it more likely to happen at night or more likely to happen during the day?
If I sleep with my head up, straight up or to the left, it's guaranteed.
Because one thing you can do at night is you can wear a TMJ night brace, which may be helpful for a while. Sometimes sort of just getting things to heal and your brain will then reorient and chew the proper way. So you may want to have a night brace. That would be the first thing I would recommend for TMJ. You can buy them on the net. There are many dental supply stores that have them, but I would try a TMJ night brace. That would be number one. The next thing I'd do is I would look at the foods that tend to bother it. Are they dry foods versus wet food? Is it when I'm chewing a delicious T-bone steak, or is it when I'm having yogurt? And find out if it's a food-related issue. And if that's the case, eat slower for a while.
It's almost never when I eat.
Mm-hmm.
It's more either when I'm talking or sleeping.
Well, stop talking and don't
stop
get
sleeping. Sleeping.
I know.
Stop talking and stop sleeping. Problem solved. Next. The TMJ joint brace will definitely help with the sleeping because it usually does. Within the talking, they could have cut a nerve and nicked a nerve, and then it takes a while for your brain to learn where the tongue is. It's kind of amazing that we don't bite into our tongue more often. If you think about it, you never bite into your tongue, and it's moving all over your mouth and so your teeth, and it knows where to go all the time. So it may just take a while for the other nerves to take over and stop disturbing your tongue. But I think if you got rid of the nighttime, that might be part of it.
Well, it's very interesting because it started right after the surgery, and it seems like it's gotten a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But the surgeon did also say that it was a major deal and it could take a couple of years to heal.
Right.
I didn't know part of it.
That's right. No, that is part of it. What kind of toothpaste do you use?
Colgate.
Uh-huh. I think I'd go to Sensodyne. I do that also. Sensodyne, that just allows things to heal better. It has less abrasive in it than Colgate. And I think I'd use a Sensodyne, see if that helps.
Well, I do have TMJ anyway and was thinking about the brace, so I think that's great. I'm going to do that, and I'm trying some Sensodyne.
Thank you. Good luck. Let us know what happens.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the call. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, time again now for our medical Mythbuster segment. Today's question comes to us from Mike in Wheatland, Wisconsin. He writes, "Hi, Dr. Zorba. My favorite drink is ice water. The colder, the better. I drink it all the time, even in the winter. However, I've heard that cold beverages are bad for digestion. Is there any truth to that? Thanks, and keep up the good work."
Wonderful. There is absolutely 100% no truth to that at all. You can drink any drink as cold as you want to or as hot as you want to, frankly, as long as you don't burn your tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at ice and the history of ice, because I just happened to have read an article about the history of ice.
That sounds pretty intriguing and exciting.
Back in the day, there was a guy who made a gazillion dollars by basically, it used to be that you would carve up rivers in Wisconsin and in New England, and you would take the ice and put it into barges and then ship it down to the south for people who wanted ice drinks.
Before refrigeration.
And, well, not only before refrigeration, but people in the deep south had never tasted ice. And so it took about 20 years before they developed a taste for ice. They didn't even like it. It was like, ooh, I don't like that, because they had never actually had ice. And then once it caught on, it really caught on, and they were able to do even more of a market. I just thought I'd give you that little fun fact. Yeah. And then who made money, and then how the Carrier Corporation figured out how to do it, and before you know it, we all have ice. But so in a lot of cultures, like in a Tibetan culture and in India, where I've traveled quite extensively, they don't put ice in their drinks at all. Mm-hmm. They just don't do it. It's not their culture. They've never learned about ice, and it doesn't taste good to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's now developed this myth that ice is bad for your digestion, and the answer is ice is not bad for your digestion, and drinking ice water may keep you from becoming that. So drink on.
Wait a minute. Keep you from becoming
well,
fat
because you're
drinking
ice water
instead
right
of sunny,
iced Coke.
Okay. All right.
That's right. Or iced Dr. Pepper.
Got
or
it.
Something
Got
else.
Got it. Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Just send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. And a listener now in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hi. How are you all?
Fine. What's up?
Well, my problem is a friend's problem, actually. And the reason I'm calling is because he is deaf, and it has to do with his fingers. He's a teacher, and he teaches sign language. And being that he's deaf, that's his only way of communication, using his hands. So he uses it, you know, pretty much all day. Recently, I'd say about maybe the last 2 months, his left hand, his pinky finger, no, I'm sorry, his ring finger, mm-hmm. I guess that's the fourth mm-hmm. finger. Anyway, it locks on him.
Mm-hmm.
He can be like maybe making a kind of close his hands, and then he'll try to open, and that finger locks,
uh-huh.
and it just pops
okay.
open, uh-huh. and it's with pain.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he wakes up, and it's really painful, mm-hmm. and I guess it's not until it kind of warms up, you know, during the day that it gets better.
Mm-hmm.
But I see him always, like, holding his finger
mm-hmm.
With his other hand and just kind of, like, either massaging it or something. Now, I ask him about it, and he says that it doesn't radiate up the arm or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of goes on the inside of the palm area, right, to
mm-hmm.
the mid-palm area,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of just massages it all
mm-hmm.
the time. So I made an appointment for him with a hand specialist,
mm-hmm.
and it's coming up, but
mm-hmm.
I wanted to find out maybe from you guys, see if you all have an answer.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking, is it tendonitis?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a nerve problem?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know.
Oh, sure.
And I, you know, he does keep complaining of pain to it.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
I feel for him because he's signing all the time.
Yeah. You have just perfectly described something we call a trigger finger, and it can be cured. And that's the good news. So a trigger finger, if you read about it on the net, it's actually a little swelling in the tendon in the palm. We have pulleys in the palm that kind of keep our muscles together because the fingers themselves don't have much in the way of muscles. It's really the muscles in our palm and in our wrist that really pull them apart. And when there can be a swelling in the tendon, it kind of flips against another tendon that is going perpendicular to that, and it gets stuck. And it's called the trigger finger.
Uh-huh.
And the initial treatment for a trigger finger is to have an injection with a steroid into the finger, and that will often take care of it. And if not, after a lot of hand surgeons will say after 2 injections or 3 injections they think it should be operated on. It's not a complex operation. But the main thing, the take home, is when he goes to this hand doctor, he should say that he wants to have it injected first. You don't want to go to a hand doctor who said, well, this is a trigger finger. I think we should operate. Try the injection, because now I've had trigger fingers, so I know exactly what it is. You know, you get injected and it gets better. And one of mine has lasted for 5 years, and the other one I've had a couple of injections. And because of that, I may be looking at surgery, but certainly not with 1 injection. So you described trigger finger perfectly. You should go to medical school. You did a great job of describing it. And this is going to help him a lot. You're definitely, let me tell you, it's going to make a big, big difference. It's something that we actually can cure in the hands, and that's great.
Okay. So another question is, if he leaves it alone, what will it go away?
No, usually it doesn't go away. And I wouldn't leave it alone. This is one of the things I wouldn't leave alone. He needs his fingers for sign language, and injection doesn't hurt very much. I mean, it hurts a little bit, but he'll be so much better. He should definitely have it injected, there's no doubt. Because often it'll stay for the rest of his life, and he needs his fingers. Even,
right.
I mean, we all need our fingers.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it, and I don't sign language, but I didn't like it because it would wake me up at night and be painful and uncomfortable. And if you can get a bit of pain and discomfort with an injection and you sign
uh-huh.
language, go for it.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now, is there a chance of it
Well, yes, you said that it can come back because he may
that's
need
right.
even a second or a third injection.
That's right. And then if that's the case, then surgery. And the surgery is not a long surgery, and it's very effective.
Okay. Very good. I will let him know, and he'll have to keep his appointment with the doctor. He was hoping that he could cancel it.
No,
and find
no.
another solution.
No. But it's a good solution. Even though he's got to go there, it's a good solution.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Relay this to my friend.
You're welcome. Great. And it's so nice you're such a good friend to your friend.
Thank you so much for the call. And before we head out today, Zorba, time to let one of our listeners give us a piece of their mind in a segment we call Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's correction
Wait
comes...
a minute. Where's the music?
No music for a disagree.
Oh, God. No. But don't we have like bum,
yeah,
bum,
it should be like,
ba-dum,
oh,
bum,
yeah, exactly.
ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum.
Today's correction comes from a listener named Caitlin, who wrote to us referring to Zorba's recent comments about not being able to breastfeed an adopted child. She writes, Dr. Zorba, I heard the question from the woman who wants to breastfeed her adopted child, a woman, particularly one who has given birth and breastfed before, will make breast milk with sufficient stimulation of the breast. She may never have the kind of supply she had after the first baby, and it will take several days of stimulation, but she will make breast milk. The term is relactation. I agree with your advice not to mess with testing the milk. Any environmental toxins that may be present in her milk, such as mercury, is far outweighed by the benefits of human milk compared to formula. Thank you, and I very much enjoy your show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for correcting me on that. I was not aware of that, and I appreciate it. Thanks for the comment.
Do you disagree with something Zorba said on the show? Just post it on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org, or you can post it on Facebook.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Or
Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime.
I want to see if you can pronounce it.
800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Colburn. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0110Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.